Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. This week we are sharing some short stories by Duluth author Connie Ellis. She was the author of The Ice Dancer, the novel recently shared on Literally from the North Shore. Today we'll start out the week with a story called Chicken Chicken. It's set in Denver, Colorado, but inspired by the mystery surrounding the disappearance of the giant Two Harbors chicken. The Two Harbors chicken, of course, has since been returned. This story will be followed by The Crow, which takes place in a cabin on Lax Lake, a reverie of childhood, fishing, and the life of a crow.
Chicken, chicken. Three boxes, that's it. Carol can't get over how her life at the office amounts to nothing more than three boxes. Two and a half, really. The third is only for shoes. 9 years, one box for every 3 years. She tapes the last box closed, pausing beside the worn green carpet under her chair where she sat for the last 9 years. "Well, that's it," she says, picking up the last box, the box of shoes, and marches out the door. "Goodbye," she says to no one as the door locks behind her. The street is empty on this Saturday morning, and she sees no one until she crosses the street to her parked car. A man is sitting on the sidewalk beside the Guarantee Savings and Loan, flexing an artificial leg, which he slips into an army-style boot. He seems aware of Carol, but oblivious to her. As she clicks her seatbelt into place, she can see him in her rearview mirror as he laces his boot, captivated. She watches him comb his shoulder-length hair carefully and methodically before she drives off. She turns the corner, aware that she's left not exactly a war zone, but it doesn't feel quite normal either. Yet it is pleasant, driving so early in the morning with the road to herself. It seems longer ago somehow, and the roads seem wider, quieter. Edward Hopper roads. She turns the radio to the classical station, pleased to hear the melodic German leader, which she is pretty sure is Schubert. Humming along to the German words, she sings in English when she remembers a line. "I came here as a stranger I did part." Though it's out of her way, she makes a left turn onto the boulevard and drives slowly along the wide street, well below the minimum speed limit, as if she were in a parade, which seems just right for the morning. Her grandfather loved German Lieder. She sighs, thinking of him, recalling his Sunday afternoon drives in the antique Model T Ford, dressed in a dark suit and vest, holding the steering wheel squarely, a paper bag of buttermints by his side. The scene and the music combine in such a pleasantly familiar way that she can almost taste the smooth, melt-in-your-mouth buttermints of yesteryear. Picturing him sitting upright, his formal hat tipped slightly toward the open road, she is listening to the music with her grandfather and wants to enjoy it and not think. If she thinks, he'll vanish, drifting up into the clouds, and she'll be all alone with the dark, beautiful music. He loved to sing, and he played the bass fiddle. As a child, she would peek into the storage room next to his bedroom where the big instrument was stored. How she loved its musical curves, its coppery, shining wood, but mainly she loved its size and thought of the bass as a giant's violin. It took up the entire storage room. It seemed like something from one of her fairy tales, but when she started first grade, the room was plastered off. Was the bass enclosed in the room? Buried alive, so to speak? She doesn't remember asking anyone. Perhaps because she wanted it to be there, on the other side of the wall. Even now, she likes to think of the bass sealed in behind the wall of the old family home as some proof of the existence of her childhood and of her grandfather. As she continues along the boulevard of flowers, the roadside zinnias of scarlet and coral appear to flow along beside her, with her. The heart-red river of flowers of the median are such a vibrant hue, they seem to overflow the road and nearly touch the car as she drives along, till they end abruptly as she comes to the plum trees, their ripe fruit fallen in messy clumps along the curb. From here, the boulevard becomes a gray, flowerless road of drive-ins, gas stations, and cheap motels. It was 9 years ago, at this time of year, that she started her job as an accountant. Though unlike today, it was a gray, rainy day. In downtown was a morass of mud. She was relieved when it finally got cold and the mud froze up. How she hated walking along the haphazard trail of odd-sized planks laid out along the torn-up street that was to become a cobblestone mall. It was a horse and buggy road back then. Not that she had ever seen one, but there was mud oozing up onto the boards on wet days, slippery and dangerous. And on dry days, the boards were covered with thick clumps of mud, spread thick like sloppy plasterwork. A small board would lead to a wide board, which slanted down to a flat plank, which veered off to the left or the right. There was no logic to the makeshift boardwalk, and its lack of form bothered Carol's mathematical sensibility. Yes, it had seemed like a war zone then, too, with as many buildings going up as coming down. During lunch hour, she was both fascinated and repelled by the reckless abandon of the boom ball, crashing into brick walls, raising dust, exposing interiors. One lunch hour, she stood entranced, looking at a blue door 3 stories up, framed by the faded yellow walls of an old office space. It was like theater, the set for an avant-garde urban play. Who had worked in that yellow office year after year? Who had come and gone through that blue door? What were their names, those people who rode an elevator to that third floor and occupied so many square feet of space, a quarter of a mile up in the air, year after year? Did they smoke, tell jokes, eat lunch at their desks? Now she is one of the people from the past, even if it is her own past, and even though her building still stands. The boulevard has turned into Ravenwood Road. Carol turns off the main road and pulls in between Chicken Chicken and Dern's Good Burgers. Getting out of the car, she can still see the cityscape behind her. Funny, she never noticed before how much the buildings look like tombstones. Now she can see a whole city of tombstones, a regular cemetery of tombstones. Some tall, some short, and even some with curved tops like old fashioned R.I.P. gravestones. And if she squints, the windows resemble faint hieroglyphics. Seeing something? A man startles her, coming up from behind. He looks off toward the city with her, chewing on something out of a paper bag that smells like rancid grease. Ordinarily, she wouldn't talk to someone like this, a man from this end of town, who smells like chicken grease and rubber tires. Tombs, she says. The skyscrapers look like tombs. He doesn't answer, at least not right away, but pulls his head back and studies the cityscape like he's listening for something. Pretty fancy car, he says after a long pause, still looking at the far-off buildings. I never drove a Cadillac. Big car. Well, it is big. Old, though, 5 years old, she says. Still proud of the sturdy white car, though she never would have bought it if her Honda hadn't broken down in the middle of Nebraska. They towed her to Kearney, and then she couldn't wait for a new transmission, not during tax season. And she liked that it was the banker's car, the bank president's car. Driving off in that big white Cadillac, she had felt giddy and laughed for no reason at all, just happy to be driving along the Nebraska highway across Willacather's prairie, past an occasional friendly tree or a hawk sitting still as a clothespin on a roadside fence. And she loved the feeling of being on the road, of being neither here nor there, but just traveling along and in such a car. Even today she marvels at how a person can start out in a Honda and end up in a Cadillac, all in the same day. She thinks she recognizes the top of the guarantee savings and loan, Pretty sure it's the one with the little dome next to that sharp bottle green glass building she's always disliked. The greasy man is taller than Carol, but skinny, unlike herself. She suspects his hair was probably red once, but now is a faded blend of colors, like the old ferret at the pet store where she buys pet food. She never trusted that ferret, never got too close. After all, it was a wild animal, an unpredictable wild animal. This man's hair is short, like the ferret's too, very short, but his eyebrows are long. Some of those hairs must be 2 inches long. She's been staring, she realizes, and turns quickly back to the skyscrapers, though he seems not to have noticed. Egyptian tombs, she says. Maybe kind of like the pyramids, only they're not dead, the ones working in them buildings. Oh, they're dead, some of them, she responds. I suppose, half dead anyways. I know I'd be dead, cooped up like that. My uncle could have got me in there, got me a desk job in insurance. That's what he did. That was back when I was in construction. Oh, that was quite a few years back. I told him thanks, but no thanks. Couldn't work in one of them buildings, cooped up like a chicken. Buck, 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 buck. He suddenly clucks like a chicken, moving his elbows up and down. You like chicken? This is my place, he says before she can answer, nodding towards chicken behind them. Maybe you saw my big chicken. If you ever drove by here 10 years ago, you'd have seen it. 20-foot-tall white chicken, big eyes, eyelashes made out of rope, and red feet, red comb on top. Smiled at everybody. Business is still good, though, but Betty left after they stole the chicken. Sorry to say, but marriage makes women nuts. Some women, that is. She blamed me for the chicken getting stolen. Now why would I steal my own chicken? He looks down at the ground and kicks a piece of cinder. She lives with her sister now up in Cheyenne. My grandmother kept chickens, Rhode Island Reds. She had some rare ones, too, a type that laid blue eggs, Carol says. Blue? That's real nice. We thought about raising our own chickens once, but never got around to it. Dan Dern, he says, turns to formally shake Carol's hand. Carol, she offers, and I do like chicken. Isn't that other place called Dern something over there? My brother's place, Dern's Good Burgers. Not all that good, though, if you want to know the truth. I'm the cook in the family, always have been. You hungry? Lunch chicken's all done. Come on in and I'll show you some real home-style fried chicken. I just changed the oil this morning, too. Fried in nice fresh corn oil. I change the oil once a week, regular. And it's on the house. Not that someone driving a Cadillac needs someone buying for them. We're not open for lunch yet, so I don't have to be jumping up and down. Not that I've been very busy lately. You try my chicken, and I'll make us some good hot coffee. I like someone keeping me company. He rolls up his paper bag into a tight, thin roll. The way you was looking out at the city, I'd say you could use a chicken leg or two. Helps a person figure things out. Chicken legs do. He narrows his eyes and starts toward the restaurant, expecting her to follow. She does. He stops abruptly and stamps his foot. What, should she just get in the car and drive off? Why did she even stop here? This is where the chicken sat, he tells her. The one that was stolen? Yep. She looks down at the ground. You'd have to know it, he says. 10 years of weather and there's no sign left, hardly. Maybe just here. He taps his shoe on a few pieces of black volcanic rock. Chicken legs give you dreams. Betty always said that. Said that legs show you which way to walk, so if you eat a couple, you'll have a dream that'll tell you where to go. She had one of those dreams herself, took her straight to Wyoming. Carol follows Dan through the screen door. At the counter, he fixes the S in French fries, which has slid down on the menu board, but it falls back into a crack as soon as he turns around. She reads down the list. Fried chicken, French fry, sweet corn, seasonal, Coke, root beer, coffee, donuts. "Have you ever thought about getting another chicken?" she asks as he pulls out a chair for her at the table by the window. "No, not anymore. I did, though, for a while. I knew this guy who made birdhouses. We'd get together once in a while and make plans. We drew a big chicken on newspapers spread out on the kitchen floor. Actually, he did the drawing, and I'd be in charge of taping them together. The papers always fell apart, though, or got all mixed up, and we'd just end up drinking beer." He laughs quietly to himself and shakes his head. "I thought Betty might come back if I had another chicken. Even thought about a big rooster. I know she would have had to come back for that. But, you know, I got kind of used to living by myself. Never would have thought so once. But then I can cook. A lot of men can't cook. And she was no easy woman. Real fussy she was. Guess I've just stopped thinking about getting another chicken." He looks up apologetically. "Excellent legs," she says. "She's never eaten chicken for breakfast before and is afraid she probably looks a greasy mess with her lipstick smeared. She can feel the grease on her nose." "More coffee?" he asks. "Yes, half a cup," she says. "That would be nice." She's enjoying herself. Knows it's weird, but she's having fun. She's not afraid of Dan. The little tables are spotless, with yellow tablecloths, each with its own red plastic carnation and a Coke bottle. Out the window, she can no longer see the city. She watches the clouds while Dan leaves for coffee and is surprised when she hears him grinding beans back in the kitchen. An odd, barge-like cloud floats before a few fluffier ones, and she sees what looks like a bass fiddle and a man with a hat. It's her grandfather lying down in a bass fiddle-shaped coffin. She's sure it really looks like that, and can even make out the outline of his large nose and prominent chin. She watches as the coffin floats along to the north, slowly like a large boat moving in water. The coffin is turning into another shape by the time Dan comes back with the coffee, which smells wonderful. "Thanks. I usually have cornflakes for breakfast, but this was good. I really enjoyed it," she tells him. "Enjoy your coffee, too." "French vanilla," he says, watching for her reaction as she takes a first sip. "Mmm," she says, thinking this all may not even be real. Maybe if she drove by here tomorrow, there would just be an empty, dusty spot on the road. No chicken. She might see a man sitting on a blanket adjusting an artificial leg. "Life sure is something," he says. "Doesn't matter what happens. If you can have a cup of coffee like this, it's pretty darn good." "Well, it is," Carol agrees. "But I'd better be on my way now." "Thanks, really. It was just what I needed." She wipes her mouth with a napkin, smooths her skirt down, and settles back into her more formal self, stretching out her hand to say goodbye. As Carol drives out of the dusty parking lot, the first customer of the day drives into the chicken lot, and in her rear view mirror, she sees Dan at the door, turning the closed sign over to open. Licking the last of the grease off her lips, she accelerates and drives back toward the Boulevard of Flowers. The Crow. Close your eyes. Okay, they're closed. Now open them. Are they open? They're open. What do you see? You're right, nothing. Can you see my eyes? No, nothing. Black space surrounds us. It has no edges. Feels velvety, like we're floating in it. Are we the night now? Are we blind? I ask my brother. He doesn't answer right away, then tells me it's dark because the generator is off and there aren't any lights in the lodge or the cabins, and it's raining so we can't see the moon. Nobody knows, he says as an afterthought, and tells me to go to sleep. Night then. Night. David? What? I like the dark. I listen to the earth humming up into the trees, to the soft pattering rain on the cabin roof, and the steady rain falling on the lake. David? What? Can the fish hear the rain? No, they're asleep. Go to sleep now. I'm asleep. I snuggle into my pillow, which I have calculated is filled with the feathers of four white swans. We always have a pillow fight before we go to sleep. Toss pillows over the 3-foot opening at the top of the wall that separates the bedrooms of our cabin. Curtain David and I are on one side, and our mom and dad are on the other side. It's wildly thrilling to throw pillows at our parents, throwing the pillows over the empty space into the unknown. I become mental doing this, and Kurt considers the bed his trampoline and jumps up and down as the pillows fly back and forth, occasionally hitting him, which sends him into massive giggling fits, and he ends up collapsing on the feather bed. He's 2. How smart our parents are, knowing they'll tire him for a sound night's sleep. David is the tallest and the best athlete on our side, but no one ever wins these feather fights, and our dad always ends it with, "Okay, that's enough," and we stop. We never say, "Just once more." I think I'm the only one still awake, because David hasn't moved for a long time. My swans are also asleep, so I concentrate on the rain on the roof, a lovely music as nice as my mother's humming in the kitchen, though of course she's asleep now, and my father is snoring. We'll have to bail out the boat with the red coffee cans tomorrow, and I won't be able to go fishing early with my dad. My mom doesn't like lake fishing, and David and Kurt never want to get up early like I do to go fishing, so just my dad and I go down the lake, which we have completely to ourselves when it's glassy and still and the morning light makes your hands look orange. The lake itself is just waking up when we get into the boat and the water is so still and clear, we surprise the long black leeches near the dock. My dad puts on his hat and off we go. He keeps the motor on low until we pass the dock by the cabin with the yellow hydroplane, and when we get out to the center of the lake, we go faster, and I get to steer all the way to our point by the big rock, where we fish for bass. I love being in charge of the boat, feeling the motor's vibration in my hand through the black rubber handle of the old green Mercury motor as we move down the lake. My dad takes over when we get close to the fishing point because he knows where the rocks are, though you can see their underwater shadows in the sun, and I could probably maneuver around the rocks myself. After the anchor is down and the worm is on the hook, I know exactly how to hold my pole and just how to move it when I get a bite. The fish is like your shadow in the water when you hook it, and you have to pull it in through the thick, heavy water into the boat where the fish has to die so you can do it again. Everything must be done just right and at the right moment. My dad smokes a cigar while we fish and we hardly talk at all. Also, you don't move around in the boat. My dad pulls in the anchor when we're done. It's really an old paint can filled with cement, and he puts the can of worms in the back corner out of the sun. I reel my line in tight enough for my hook to stay on the reel, and then I get to steer on the way back. We always pass my library going home, which is the place where the reeds grow and the yellow water lilies bloom. It's the spot I can row to by myself to read comics, usually Little Lulu, Casper the Friendly Ghost, or Uncle Scrooge. I always take a package of Junior Mints along to eat while I read. I get them from the lodge, but I buy the comics in Duluth. The tall reeds are where you can settle down in the bottom of the boat, and no one can see you. Once someone motored over, thinking I was a lost drifting boat. When you're in the center of the library, there are reeds all around you, and you can see to the sandy bottom of the lake, where it's shallow, and the sunlight shines on the sand, making the reeds a golden underwater forest where schools of small striped perch dart in and out. You probably don't know Mrs. Junker, my second grade teacher. She would love how neat and regular it is down there in the straight green reeds. She makes us draw with a ruler. We all have to draw the same picture. The last picture was of a forest of 7 trees without leaves, only the trunks without branches. We drew lines for the outline of each tree using a ruler and then made long straight brown crayon lines until each tree trunk was filled in. The same ruler technique was used for the blue sky between the trees. Mrs. Junker walked up and down the aisles between the desks in her crayon green dress, which I believe is just like the green dress Miss Brooks wears on the radio, only Miss Brooks' dress is silkier. Of course you can't see her on the radio, but I still believe this to be true. Mrs. Junker peers over your shoulder with her serious red face. Make sure you are using the ruler. Everyone's drawing looks pretty much the same, and when we're done, she shellacks each drawing and puts them up all around the room for PTA night. Mrs. Junker does have nice geraniums, though. Every window has two red-blooming geraniums, and each student gets a week when it's their turn to water all the geraniums. She likes precision and many of the same thing. "Wake up, here's the funnies," my mom says, and I wake up. I'm the only one still in bed, and the rain is still falling on the roof, and I can smell the fire from the wood-burning stove. "Are we having pancakes?" I ask, stretching my arms out of my quilt. My mom says yes when David gets back, pretty soon. The rain is running down the windows, and the pine trees are dripping wet. It's mostly drizzling now, not really raining, but there's no sun. Kurt is chasing our little dog Buzzy under the table, but I'm not paying attention because I'm waiting for the colored squares of the heavy wool quilt to come to life like they usually do when the quilt becomes a very large, funny paper. But today the squares are empty, even the best yellow ones. So I put the regular funnies over my face and listen to the slow dripping rain on the roof from the trees. I hear fast footsteps, and the door slams, and David rushes in, all breathless, tells us to look. "Look what I shot," he says. I sit up, and then he's dripping rain on the bed. He's all wet, too. His hair is wet, and water is running off his glasses and his hat. He's wearing his quiver and holding his bow, and he holds up a big black crow, all wet and dead, its feathers blacker and deader than any bird I've ever seen. I'm so excited as he holds the crow straight out to me. What a thrilling, dead black crow. David is so happy. This is wonderful, and I'm crying. But then my father comes in, and before he says a word, we know this is bad. David is brave, and his face turns white. "You never shoot what you can't eat," he says. My father is like an angry stone, and my whole body shivers. David leaves quickly. I know he's gone to bury the crow, and that the hot rain will be on his face, and he won't say a word when he comes back in, and we'll have pancakes, and everyone will act like the crow never happened. This is when I realize it's harder to be a boy than a girl, and I pretend to read Dagwood under the covers, but all I see is the rain dripping from David's glasses out in the woods, where he's burying the crow under the moss beneath the tall, sad pines, which are nothing at all like Mrs. Junker's trees. My mother will make David feel better when he comes back, and she'll hum while she heats water for the dishes, and we'll all start to relax. She'll let him wash the dishes because the warm, soapy water is comforting. David opens the door, so you hardly hear it creak, and after he hangs up his bow and quiver out on the porch, we eat our pancakes and the dishes get done. Then we drive to Finland to buy groceries and cream soda. And on the way back, everything gets back to normal. We talk about wood ticks and how I won for having the most on the last trip back to Duluth. 8 wood ticks, beating the old record by 2. And finally, it stops raining. The end.